to serve you, Dr. Weir.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Welcome, children of the night, to another So Good It's Scary edition of Junk Food Cinema right here on Film School Rejects. And you are so welcome for that beautiful audio experience that just winded its way into your earlobes and up into your
brain.
That is the name of the song.
Event Horizon.
We have gone on way too long. Oh my gosh. That's right, we're the show that gives out full-size Snickers bars while all the other film casts hand out toothbrushes and bags of pennies. I'm your horrible host, Brian Salisbury, and I'm joined by my deadly friend and creepy co-host, novelist-slash-screamwriter, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Oh dear God, you went there.
Oh, we've got a whole month of this.
Oh,
we've
Jesus
got a
Christ.
Whole month of Halloween
fucking
puns.
October, man.
I'm, of course, making so many Halloween references because it's finally October. Oh my God, I'm so excited. Or as we call it around the junkyard, Schlocktober. And as such, we begin a new curated series here on Junk Food Cinema. But before we go into that, let's keep some house. I want to remind you that Junk Food Cinema is available on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. And you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And also, any movies we talk about, you'll see there's little Amazon links for them. If you use those links, even if you don't buy that item, as long as you get to Amazon via that link, it benefits us. And we really do appreciate it. So...
All that just happened. Like the screamwriter and the Schlocktober and
Event Horizon.
Well, that definitely happened.
Yes.
But that's because we're starting this off by talking about Event Horizon.
See, the 1990s were an interesting time for film because, well, you had people like Tarantino, Linklater, and Rodriguez setting off the indie revolution. Genre film kind of took a back seat. And I think it's, you know... It's symptomatic of the pendulum swing that you actually talked about on a previous episode, Cargill, where every so often audiences seem to sway back and forth in their desire for more grounded realism and then more fantastical fare. And it seems like the 90s has not yet had the major nostalgic push into utter reverence as has the 80s. I mean, it's getting there. It's getting there for sure.
Well, and that's why I find it interesting that we're starting here. And here's the interesting thing about horror is... Let's just get a brief history of modern horror. You know, in the 70s, you had a lot of the guys breaking the rules, and you had a lot of genre shakeups.
Toby Hooper.
You know, Toby Hooper, the emergence of John Carpenter, you know, mainstream hits like Jaws and The Exorcist. Mm-hmm. You know, you had, you know, more mainstream horror that was treated very, you know, reverently, you know, things like The Omen. And what that led into was, you know, that we had this kind of crazy mishmash potpourri of the 70s where all these auteurs came out of and just all these talented filmmakers. And then in 1979, Halloween happened. And Halloween set off a revolution. And a couple people went and copied Halloween. And one of them
being Sean S. Cunningham.
Sean S. Cunningham being principal among them by making Friday the 13th, which made so much money, costing so little that the following year there was an explosion of slasher films. So what we saw in the early 80s was mainstream horror was very pricey, expensive. Mainstream, you know, George C. Scott and The Changeling and, Steven Spielberg producing the Gremlins and the Poltergeist. Mm-hmm. Poltergeist, not The Poltergeist. And cheaper indie horror was all slasher fare.
Right.
And then somewhere around the mid-80s, it started getting goofy. And by 1987, slasher horror had become a joke. And even the series were making fun of themselves. You have Jason Takes Manhattan. Mm-hmm. You've got, you know, Freddy Krueger just getting silly.
Freddy Krueger using the power glove.
Wes Craven making Shocker. You know, you're getting this really oddball stuff. And that and horror had no idea where it was going. And you had a bunch of guys in the early 90s trying to make some really great effective horror in an era that people were kind of done with horror.
Yeah.
And horror would stagnate with lots of interesting attempts until 96 when Scream happened.
See, and that's funny. That's what's funny to me is that it's a postmodern deconstruction of the genre, and yet it's also probably going to become how the genre is remembered from the decade.
Yes.
Is the movie that is basically nodding backwards to the history of the genre.
Right, right. And Scream changed everything, and everybody ripped off Scream. And
which makes no sense to me whatsoever.
No, but that's what happened. Is the late...
No, you're right.
The reason why 90s is such a weird time is the first half of the 90s are all very experimental, with even Wes Craven being experimental with a postmodern deconstruction. And then from that point on, everything was super slick slasher movies for the next 4 years.
I Know What You Did Last Summer, Urban Legend.
And that led into, that fed into torture porn, because as those went as far as they could go, all of a sudden indie filmmakers are like, well, this is what people want. Well, let's go further. And then you have Saw, which tipped off what became known as torture porn.
Yeah.
And that led to Hostel, and that led to, you know, the Rob Zombie movies, and that led to all the craziness that was going one direction while J-horror went another. And then all of a sudden Paranormal Activity came along, and we saw a return to storytelling and paranormal stories. Mm. And that's how you end up with people looking for those, and me actually getting a gig. And that's, you know, and that, so what we're talking about here and what we've decided to focus on is that great experimental period in the early 90s, when people were taking chances on interesting storytelling, and sometimes it was a throwback, sometimes it was trying to look forward, but all of these films were trying to do something bigger than genre was allowing at the time, and audiences didn't necessarily glom onto these movies.
Yeah.
But in this case, in Event Horizon's case, Event Horizon has become a bit of a cultural phenomenon.
I will admit that for a while, I labored under the misconception that the 90s were shit for horror, and then it occurred to me, it wasn't at all a bad decade for horror if one only knew where to look. And that's why we're beginning this underrated horror series of the 90s, and this week's voyage into the unheralded brings us to the Event Horizon, because the thing about Event Horizon is that it is kind of a throwback. It is actually a nod to one very specific horror film from the 80s, and it did something with that horror film that that own franchise tried to do and failed. Take it to space.
Yes.
Obviously, with Event Horizon, we're talking about director W.S. Anderson, who doesn't have the best track record, I guess, with critics. His films don't tend to be the ones that are heralded as classics. I mean, he does a lot of video game adaptations and remaking Death Race and, you know, doing all of the Resident Evil films with his wife.
I was really harsh on him for a long time. And then I watched this great documentary on William Castle, and in watching how William Castle dealt with who he was as William Castle, while watching it, I was like, holy shit, this is Paul W.S. Anderson. Here's this guy who's making movies to entertain his 13-year-old self that 13-year-olds are falling in love with and are going to herald as classics in the future. Now, some of his films I absolutely love from the get-go. You know, Mortal Kombat was a lot of fun, and for the longest time, in fact, I would still argue that Mortal Kombat is probably the best video game movie ever made.
Faint praise, but praise. Faint praise,
yes. But that was one of the problems we ran into, you know, when we started working on Deus Ex, was the fact that, you know, we knew that we had a shot at making the best video game movie ever made, because no one had actually made something that everyone could agree is the best video game movie ever made, or even deserves that. But then he made Death Race, which I absolutely love. And what I found out going back through his stuff to find the movies of his that really work and the movies that really don't, you just have to look at how much CG he relied upon in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
When he's dealing with practical elements and most of the film is practical, his films are really, really entertaining, great, and he creates these wonderful environments that you just fall into. When he's playing around with almost entirely CG, that's when his movies become dog shit.
And that's what's interesting about Event Horizon, is it seems like it's a complete 50-50 split. Is that there is a lot of practical, but there are also some incredible digital shots. I mean, the opening shot of the film where we're actually seeing the space station over the Earth is one elaborate you know, computer generated shot that actually took the longest time of any of the shots in the movie and only lasts about 45 seconds tops. But you know, you have great CG actually throughout the whole movie, but you also have these wonderful, practical, grisly, monstrous effects as well.
Well, but the ship is entirely practical.
The ship is practical.
And that's what works about this film is these actors are on this set. They're in this world. You juxtapose this against something like Anderson's Three Musketeers, where almost the entire film is green screen.
Right.
And the actors just, they have no idea what to do. They can't interact with their world. They can't get in it. So it looks like a bunch of people goofing around in a cartoon.
Yeah.
And he's never, but that's what works about Death Race. You know, Death Race, he insisted on doing all that stuff practically.
The Dreadnought is actually a real vehicle that they built in Death Race.
And they would have to take an hour to reload the guns on those things because they'd have to put 6,000 rounds in these machine guns and make these cars work. Mm-hmm. And that's why that film feels so visceral and real and raw,
right?
Because when a director is standing there next to his own creations, he can see how to shoot it best.
Yeah.
When he's got, you know, compositors sitting there designing it and then coming over and go, yes, no, hey, maybe change this a little bit, it becomes too big a palette, and some directors can't handle it, and he can't. But you let him build a set, you give him a crew to build his, you know, and a great design team, and he comes up with something like Event Horizon.
Which I would argue is his absolute best film. From start to finish.
I think Death Race is.
Really?
But, yes. No, I think Death Race is better than Event Horizon. Although, I also have the historical point of, I went and saw Event Horizon on opening weekend, and it was a disappointment. For a lot of us horror fans, when it first came out, we were really excited about it, and then it didn't prove to be what we expected it to.
Hmm.
But through the lens of time, going back and revisiting it without those expectations, you get to see the movie for what it really is and get to see it for the magic that it is. And I missed that the first time. I was like, but it came out, you know, in 95, right?
97, actually.
97?
Yeah.
You know, this is when I was...
But they had been working on it for a couple of years.
Yeah. So. I was 22 years old and still had I'm in film school pretension and didn't quite embrace this movie, but a lot of people didn't. Event Horizon was joked about for a long time, but recently people have been revisiting it, have been talking about it again, and I saw lots of references to it over the last 6 months, including and climaxing at the video that we played a clip from at the beginning by 357 Lover, Event Horizon. And I started looking back on it and like, wow, this is one of those movies that at the time did not catch, but is going to have its life for a long time and go on to supersede many of those films that did better around it.
I mean, it's not a perfect film by any stretch of the imagination, and there exists more than one overtly silly interlude, but overall, it's a legit fantastic piece of science fiction, and I really do think it's his best film. And important to note here are all the films that Anderson turned down to make Event Horizon. Like, he was very passionate about this project because Mortal Kombat made a shit ton of money.
Yes.
So studios were keen on him helming some other big budget PG-13 outing, but he wanted to do something heavier and something darker, which is why he turned down both X-Men and X-Files. He also turned down, by the way, Alien Resurrection, though that end up obviously did get an R rating. Anderson's initial cut of this film was 130 minutes long. And way, way more violent, which is incredible when you consider how grisly and unsettling and how violent the cut that exists is.
Is there a director's cut out there of this?
See, that's the other thing, is that for years, Anderson and his producer talked about wanting to do a director's cut. And, you know, there exists a special edition DVD that has a few extra bonus scenes, but a lot of them don't even have dialogue or special effects done. They're just kind of like left over from an old VHS tape. And it's thought that many of the elements were either lost or destroyed, but apparently there is someone released a VHS copy of his initial cut. It exists out there probably in the annals of tape trading lore and not like something that you can readily get your hands on. But if anyone can find it, I think we have a duty as fans of this film to jump into our spaceships and travel to the farthest flung dark corners of the universe to find this tape.
I really would like to see that, because there are one of the problems with this movie is that there are some moments of tripping up in the storytelling. You know, there's a few small minor elements that go wrong here. that I think really sully the whole. But everything else is so great about this movie, and almost everything stands up with this movie, except for some of the visual effects. I mean, at the time, the visual effects were really great. Now, when you're watching it in HD, you're like, wow, that scene where all these floating items in the air really looks really cartoony.
That's the one I was going to reference as well, but like that's literally the only one I can think of, because one of the things I noticed on my most recent visit was how well everything was holding up, you know, watches notwithstanding. But most of the effects actually I thought held up really well. And
well, he shot so much of that practically.
Yeah.
You know, almost all the hell stuff is practical. Rather than CG demons, he shot some really cool art school style stuff with some great special effects and with some practical, you know, horror effects. And it's just there are some monstrous scenes in there that are creepy as fuck.
And apparently the stuff that was cut out of his initial cut is a lot of that stuff, a lot of that sort of unnerving glimpses into hell with like orgies and sadomasochistic killings of the Lewis and Clark crew. And apparently he would shoot, well, the way he worked is that he would shoot most of the movie during the week, and then he would come in on the weekends and shoot that stuff. So it was just like, oh, and in addition, you know, just for fun on the weekends, I'm going to shoot these glimpses into hell. Well, that's what I'm going to do for fun.
One of the things, you know, he was a very early nemesis of Ain't It Cool News. You know, he was one of those guys who'd, bungled a couple of projects and kept getting attached to stuff that we didn't want him attached to. And so a couple of the guys, you know, at the site did digging and talked to people. And one of the things they came back with every time was that he knew how to pitch to a room. He knew how to get people excited about him. And he was genuinely enthusiastic and excited about every project he worked on. He loves doing this. And he would fall in love with whatever it is he's doing. If he got it right or wrong, that was, you know, a measure of his talent. But he was never one of those guys, and still, as I know, fails to remain one of those. He remains one of those guys that absolutely has a passion for doing this and doing it, you know, the way he wants to do it. And so that doesn't surprise me to hear that he went in on the weekends to shoot his hellish stuff. That was his relaxing, you know, that's how he relaxed. It's like, I got to get these images out of my head. We're going to shoot this crazy shit that I would never get away with the studio during the week, but I'm going to bring in my crew and we're going to, you know, this second unit crew, and we're going to shoot this crazy shit.
Yeah.
And so that all makes sense to me.
So a word about the characters in this film. I mean, immediately when you think about horror in space and you see, you know, a well-established crew, the first thing you think of, the paradigm, obviously, is Alien. But honestly, one of the things that I love about this movie is that it both embraces and bucks formula. I mean, we've seen movies before where, you know, an outsider joins a crew of dogged, tight-knit badasses or soldiers, and they aren't quite ingratiated into the ranks. And then it usually turns out that the outsider is the one to save the day, so the last two or three remaining crew members who are alive kind of begrudgingly respect them. But in Event Horizon, Lawrence Fishburne, who is the commander of the Lewis and Clark, the ship... I mean, I guess we should talk a little bit about what the movie's about. You know, you have a
before
ship...
Before we get to Captain Miller.
Before I get to Captain Miller. So, yeah, this there's a ship called the Event Horizon that was sent off sort of in secret to test this project where they were going to try and fold space and time to be able to travel across vast distances of space faster than the speed of light, because they were basically going to fold space and move through it. That ship disappears. And then years later, a ship called the Lewis and Clark picks up a distress signal from what appears to be the Event Horizon. So they're going off to find it. They have a doctor with them on board, played by Sam Neill. And it's really sort of about the quest to find out what happened on the Event Horizon.
Well, it's funny that you mention Alien and Aliens, because this actually very much mimics Aliens with the sequences when we get to know the crew.
Right.
We meet the crew and they're like, and they get there and they're like, all right, the company man's going to tell us what's going on. And then we get that, and we get that here as well.
Yeah, but in Event Horizon, Lawrence Fishburne, who is the commander of the Lewis and Clark, Captain Miller, he fully dislikes Sam Neill's character because he's an outsider, because he's a company man. And it turns out, he's totally justified in his mistrust. It's the one movie I've seen where the situation plays out in favor of the xenophobe, in favor of the guy who's like, we don't like outsiders at all. And it's like, you know what? We were fucking right about that. I kind of like that. I kind of like that they completely turn that trope on its ear a little bit. It's like, nope, I was right from frame one, guys. Sorry about you.
Well, and it was interesting how they went about it, too, because Sam Neill is the one who plays the doctor, Dr. Weir. And up until that point, you know, Sam Neill in this era, in the era we're talking about, you know, the early to mid 90s, he's kind of your genre dude.
He's your hero.
He's done lots of crazy stuff. He's got a career of really insanely cool genre stuff. And, you know, some hits and some misses. You know, the biggest, of course, being Jurassic Park. And then he follows
Never up, heard of it.
And then he follows up with another film that we're going to talk about that was sadly neglected called In the Mouth of Madness.
Yes, we're going to have a little bit of a Sam Neill marathon over the next couple of weeks.
And
spoiler alert.
Hell, he did. He plays the devil in the third Omen movie.
That's right.
You know, he did a lot of really interesting stuff. Hell, at this point in time, he appeared in this great little documentary shot by Peter Jackson called Forgotten Silver, where it was a totally fake mockumentary that they convinced all these hipsters was a real thing. And they convinced people that this New Zealand photographer had invented all this stuff long before and was the first great filmmaker. And it's one of the great hoaxes of its era. And Sam Neill, who's friends with Peter Jackson, went along with it and, of course, lends his credibility to this whole thing. So here's this guy who has this credibility who we're looking at going in. You know, he's playing a doctor again. He's playing a scientist again. Mm-hmm. And it's like, this is the guy from Jurassic Park. We trust him. No,
you should
he
not.
He is evil.
You know, and yet the thing is, Sam Neill is unsurprisingly outstanding in this role because for so much of the movie, even as you recognize the ship starting to take hold of him, you're still rooting for him. And, you know, it's the same effect that I imagine Jack Nicholson had on audiences who first saw The Shining. You know, of course, had they not read the book first. You're getting the sense that something...
No. The Shining the movie isn't like Shining the book.
Well, no, but you know what I mean. Like, when you're talking about the Torrance character, the Jack Torrance character, you're getting the sense that something is dangerously wrong with the guy over time, but you build an affinity for the character and you hope against hope that he'll break free of this, like, psychological black hole that's pulling away his sanity. Yeah. And it's the same with Sam Neill in Event Horizon. You're like, yeah, I recognize he's going insane, but I still like him. Like, there's still something just utterly likable about this guy. Well, you're hoping that he's going to break out of it.
Sam Neill has this great charisma, and we'll go more into this next, maybe next week or the week after when we talk about In the Mouth of Madness, because he does have this great raw charisma that even when he's being a jackass, you like him. You know, he's got that, even when he's like shaved off his accent and sounds American, he still has that, you know, South of the Equator charm that just works, and he puts that on here, you know. And but the thing is there's some great moments where he kind of puts on the charm and he comes off really sleazy. But you still like, you can't take your eyes off him. I mean, that's what's really cool about Sam Neill. But yeah, he really does that here. And Lawrence Fishburne is going full Denzel here. He's like alpha male motherfucker. Like he is like this is. He's it's one of those, it plays upon everything that's great about Lawrence Fishburne. You know, Lawrence Fishburne can play cool as a cucumber. I mean, the king of those roles is Morpheus, you know, where I am going to sit here and I'm going to talk like this, even when I'm really pissed off, and you're going to be impressed and frightened by me. and then there's these other roles where he just goes completely unhinged and almost goes full Sam Jackson, who is not, by the way, Lawrence Fishburne.
You're getting me so confused right now.
But this is one of those roles where he perfectly walks the line between that, where he maintains his cool and he's got this cool calm while he's doing it. And every time he bosses people around or cuts in, he's like, cut that shit out. It's like everybody calms the fuck down. No question.
Yep.
Like this man's in charge. And then, you know, and then he completely loses it at a few moments. And it's just like, dear Christ, I'm afraid of this guy. This guy's fucking the boss.
Well, he keeps telling people that they're going to be walking home if they don't. And it's like in space, that means something a lot different. But yeah, no, absolutely. I think it's absolutely a great, it's kind of a great 1-2 punch for the movie. It's to have Sam Neill and Lawrence Fishburne, both of whom are right at the top of their game and are just playing off each other so well with not completely different personalities in the film because they're both sort of quiet and in charge in their own regard, but like when they come to blows, it's just beautiful to watch.
Yeah. It's, I mean, this is a film that's really, as much as it's a special effects horror film, it really is a film that's about performances. It's really, hey, let's build these really awesome, dynamic, incredible sets. And then we're just going to put actors in it and let them yell at each other.
Yeah.
And it fucking works.
And we definitely need to talk about the production design on this movie because I think it's really the heart and soul of it. I mean, as much as Alien is a haunted house movie in space, Event Horizon is like The Shining in space. I mean, right down to the fact that there are waves of blood moving through the ship at one point, just looking for an elevator to burst out of. And like I said before, like there's the whole thing of Sam Neill slowly being driven insane by what appears to be a sentient, you know, capsule in which they're all being held. But apart from that, the other big influence, obviously, that you can see from space and that I referenced before is Hellraiser. I mean, the design of the gravity drive and the preceding hallway could not be more inspired by Hellraiser. And the core itself looks like a damn puzzle box, only circular.
Yeah.
And as you're watching this movie, the corridor up to the gravity drive kind of resembles like an elaborate murder device. They called it the meat grinder. It's very, very torture chic. But, you know, there are also several points throughout the movie where you have characters under the ship's influence saying that it has things to show you.
I have such wonderful things to show you.
Like, it's crazy. Yeah. It's just like...
Oh, no, this movie rips off Clive Barker left and right.
And that is why I was not surprised to find out in my research that he was actually hired in pre-production as an advisor, or as a consultant.
That doesn't surprise me at all.
Oh, okay, so this really is Hellraiser in space, but done a lot better than the actual Hellraiser in space.
Yes.
Hellraiser has a sequel where they go to space, but I prefer...
Yeah, Bloodlines.
Bloodlines. I prefer to think that Event Horizon is the good Hellraiser in space.
It is. No, it really is. You know, I mean, to be fair, though, to be really fair to Bloodlines, they didn't shoot half that script. Like, they cut half the script out before they shot it, and they were left with this.
I love that we're defending Hellraiser Bloodlines right now.
This is what we do. Wait, you love that we defend a criminally underrated film or a film that
is
may have
Hellraiser
gotten screwed over?
Is Hellraiser Bloodlines criminally... Okay, screwed over, I will give you that, but is it criminally underrated?
I have it on good authority from several people who in the know that film, if it had been realized the way they wanted to with the budget that it was supposed to have, that movie could have been great.
Yeah.
But what was shot... what they were left with to put together did not assemble into a great film. So no. I don't believe that there, I believe that there's only one Hellraiser film after part two. And that's only because I work with the guy who directed it. And so I know it exists, but no.
Because you're forced to.
Three, four, six, and everything after, I'm not a fan of. And but one and two I love, and there's lots of really cool stuff in five. Bloodlines is kind of a mess. And this feels like it's the Hellraiser series Hellraiser deserved, except that it doesn't have Cenobites. And I'm glad that it doesn't, because that was where all the other films went wrong.
Unless you count what happens to Sam Neill by the end of the movie, who he himself sort of resembles a Cenobite.
He becomes very similar to the Cenobite in the Doctor in Hellraiser 2, yeah.
Oh, yeah, there
you go. Where you have this character who's slowly devolving into, you know, getting what he really wanted. But I love that what works with Sam Neill here is that Sam Neill is so interested in science. Like, this is one of those cool underpinning character traits that you get from really good storytelling that often gets neglected by the mainstream, is that what's so interesting about Sam Neill is he's not... We've been joking about him being evil and the bad guy. He's not evil. He's a guy who came up with this really cool concept. You know, and it's a concept that people are playing around with, you know, that it's the only way around, you know, relativity at going faster than light, which is the only way to realistically travel for us between stars. You would have to fold space, and they've been playing around with things like that. And here's a guy who's like, okay, we're going to fold space and go through the hole between, and then finding out that there's something in there. It's like, holy fuck, I built the thing that found the next thing. What is that thing? I must know what it is because I fucking discovered it.
I created the Event Horizon to reach the stars, but she's gone much, much farther than that.
Like, this is my legacy. This is what my life is about. My life is, I'm the guy that poked a hole in the universe and showed that hell exists scientifically. Like, this is not, I believe in angels and devils. This is, there's a place of pure chaos underneath our world, and I found out how to get there. And he cannot wait to find out what this thing is.
Yeah.
And so he's like investigating this, and Lawrence Fishburne is doing exactly what he's supposed to do, which is be the captain and play that stereotypical role of, no, we're blowing this thing up. We're getting the fuck out of here. Fuck you and your experiment. I don't care if there's really a hell. And he's like, no. This is huge. This is the biggest discovery of mankind. You know, this is, we've just proven that there are realms outside our own realm. And we need this ship. And, mm-hmm. and Lawrence Fishburne is like, fuck you, white boy. You're walking home. I'm leaving this ship here to blow up, and we're going to pretend none of this happened and put it in a little box that will sit, next to the Ark of the Covenant in that nice big,
in that warehouse.
And we're never going to discuss this ship again.
So in a lot of ways, under that description and taking that angle into account, it's really an even more Dr. Grant than Dr. Grant.
Yeah.
Because he's come so close to the discovery of this thing that he's passionate about that once again, he allows himself to get too close to the danger. But unlike Dr. Grant, he doesn't recognize the point where he needs to get in the helicopter and get the hell off of Ila Nublar.
I would bet all the money in my pocket against all the money in your pocket that that's exactly what drew Sam Neill to this project.
Really?
That he probably looked at that and said, oh, this is taking that character and going the other direction.
Yeah.
And people are going to trust me because of Grant, and this will help me break up that Grant. Because at the time, he was getting offered all the good guy roles, and there's a certain attraction to that. But Sam Neill's always been such an interesting actor that I find it hard to believe that he ever wanted to be a mainstream A-list kind of good guy.
Mm-hmm.
He always struck me as someone who took interesting roles because he liked interesting movies.
Sure.
And I bet you he took this role because it was the anti-Grant. It was the anti-Grant.
Oh, I love it. I love that we've discovered the anti-Grant. Oh,
this, and we must push forward. This is the greatest discovery in the history of mankind.
This movie has such things to show us. I feel like my eyeballs are going to get sucked out of my head at this revelation.
Or you're going to pluck them out yourself.
Or I will pluck them out myself.
Where we're going, we won't need eyes to see.
Okay. And speak bad Latin.
Absolutely. So one thing I want to talk about that we don't talk about too often on Junk Food Cinema is the element
of junk.
Our actual junk is the costuming of this film. Because one thing that I never picked up on, and that includes my most recent viewing, it wasn't until I was doing research on this movie, the costuming, I never noticed this, specifically the design of the flight suits. So there's the flight suits that the crew wears, and then there's the actual spacesuit, that's the kind of thing they would put on and go for a walk outside of the ship. The actual spacesuits weighed about 65 pounds each, which means that standing upright in them for too long would kill the actors' backs. But here's the kicker. Because of the backpack on the back, they couldn't sit down either. So what they had to do is they rigged up what they called hanging poles that would alleviate the weight as the actor stood. So essentially, you've got the cast on meat hooks like Leatherface victims, just trying not to be crippled by the weight of their costumes. And when they weren't wearing that, they were wearing these flight suits, which contain infinitesimal details that remind us how far into the future we actually are with this movie. And that's the thing I never noticed. This is an international crew. And if you look at the American crew members' suits, the U.S. flag patch that they wear has 55 stars. Because it's assuming that we would have picked up more states by this point. It takes place, I want to say, in 2047, I believe is the year this takes place. The British crew members wear, now this is really prescient, they wear a European Union flag with 22 stars instead of the Union Jack. And then Sam Neill, as an Australian, wears a version of the Aussie flag that has removed the Union Jack and replaced it with an Aboriginal flag. So, a haunted house movie in space, a violent horror film appealing to gorehounds, perhaps. But Event Horizon is also a sci-fi movie that takes the tumultuousness of the global political landscape into consideration when thinking forward into the future of flight suit fashion.
That's pretty great stuff.
Like, how obsessed with detail Did they have to? Like, no one was ever going to notice that. No one was ever going to notice that there are 55 stars in the American patch.
But that's what great filmmakers obsessed with. And that's one of the things that I was talking about with him and practical stuff. You give him practical things to play with, and he gets really detail oriented and immerses you in the world. You know, even though his films are silly, the worlds feel really. You feel like you're in them and you buy into those universes. You buy into Death Race no matter how silly it is. You buy into Event Horizon regardless of, you know, it's we built a gravity drive and it sent us to hell. You know, yes. Is it a silly concept? Yes. Does he execute it wonderfully and take it seriously the whole time? Yeah. And details like that are what, you know, what good storytellers focus on. And this film's filled with small little details like that, which is really fascinating to watch for, especially now that we're not watching it on VHS anymore and we're watching it on HD on big screen TVs, and you go, holy shit, that's cool.
Yeah. And word about, so we talked about the director's cut. You know, there's also various alternate endings to this film. So I actually like the ending of the film. It does have one, maybe, you know, arguably cheap jump scare before the movie actually ends. But the alternate ending of the film is really interesting because one of the alternate endings doesn't have the cheap scare, and it's just the two survivors found by another rescue crew. The second one has Captain Miller fighting with a burned man from his visions at the core instead of Dr. Weir. So it's like the former crew member he talks about dying mm-hmm. in the fire in space. That's who he's fighting with. So it's much more of an internal, a literal representation of fighting with internal
that
demons.
That exists in the film.
Well, no, he's fighting with Dr. Weir. In the movie, that's the big battle at the end, is he's fighting with Dr. Weir. But in this version, it's not Dr. Weir. It's literally the guy from his visions.
Yeah.
So it's much more of a personal fight. And then the third one is, it's basically the final fight combined with the first two endings. But, instead with the Burning Man, Miller fights with Weir, and then the final scare is included. So it's kind of like everything at once. So those are the three, you know, alternate endings. And like I said, there is a tape somewhere floating out there in the deepest, darkest regions of space, in the ether, that contains W.S. Anderson's initial cut of the movie. That was, even audiences in the test screening were like, this is a little too extreme for me.
It existed, and we sent it out into space and never heard from it again. But it will show back up, I assure you. So since we're talking about, you know, we mentioned forward thinking, can I mention one of the great forward thinking things about this movie?
Yes.
That was something that just started happening in this era, and I think this might be one of the first movies to do it for its time. But the last three people alive on the Event Horizon are the two black guys and the blonde girl. The characters always the first to go in every horror movie are the ones that Paul W.S. Anderson keeps around to the end of the movie before he has our final sacrifice and we send our two characters off. And I've always loved that about this film, and they never make a big thing about it. They don't do like they do in some of the other films where they make jokes about it. But it's, it was just like, okay, are all the white guys dead? All right, good. Now we can start killing off everybody else.
Here's the best part. The blonde woman that survives at the end of the film, that character was originally written for a man. But W. Sanderson had both men and women read for the part during auditions, and he chose her because he thought she had a certain element of stage class that she would bring to the movie. So,
which she does, although he then forgets about her for 20 minutes, and you start questioning whether or not she's dead towards the end of the movie, because she appears in a scene where she's talking to someone else, and then we don't hear from her again until the climax. And it's like, oh yeah, she's still alive.
So, but I mean, if it works with bears to play dead, and that's how you survive, it apparently works with space demons, and that's exactly what I'll be doing. If that helps me survive to the end of Event
Just
Horizon.
Just don't show up in any frames. That was the problem, is that the movie actually forgets she exists. They give us no geography ever. We have no idea what's going on, and just all of a sudden she shows up, and again it's like, oh, what? Did you find a third ship? Because you were not here in this movie for 20-25 minutes.
See, but that theory,
you were gone.
That theory holds even more water because I haven't appeared in a single frame of any horror film, and here I still am.
There you are.
So that is how you survive a horror film. You just don't appear in a single frame of one.
You forget that you let the demons and the filmmaker forget that you're there. No, that's one of the things, one of the major reasons I'd be interested in seeing a director's cut of this is not only for the extreme stuff, but because I have a feeling we're missing some scenes with her in that section that ended up getting cut.
One would imagine.
That because that's the thing is we don't really spend much time. We don't get to see what she's afraid of.
No.
No. And so that makes me think that her whole storyline may have been excised for one reason or another. And maybe because it was extreme. And I'm very curious what's going on with that character, especially since she's one of the fucking survivors.
Yeah.
And if you're going to survive a movie, let me... I know more about all the characters that died than I do about both of the survivors.
Yeah. And here's some interesting extra trivia about Event Horizon. It was shot in only 10 months. Excuse me. It was completed in 10 months, okay. Which is kind of unheard of for an effects-driven movie. Like, yes. It was shot, post-production was done in 4 weeks... and then they were ready to go.
Jesus Christ, 4 weeks?
4 weeks. It was cut back from 6 to 4
That's
weeks.
That's ridiculous.
So they finished all of the post-production on this in 4 weeks. If you look at the design of the Event Horizon, at some point you will see integrated into the design of the ship an actual fucking X-Wing from Star Wars. The first shot is the Lewis and Clark is panning across it. If you look down underneath, you will see that there are pieces of an actual fucking X-Wing toy sort of molded into the design of the ship, That's which I think adorable. Is I think is fucking amazing. And Paul W.S. Anderson chose not to direct Mortal Kombat Annihilation to work on this film. So well done there. Way to dodge a bullet.
Well, Mortal Kombat Annihilation may have actually been good had he done it, and some of us might not have wanted our $7 back.
That's true.
After we paid on opening night to see Mortal Kombat Annihilation and was told by the guy selling us the tickets that he thought a team of monkeys with typewriters could have done a better job, which was the first time in my history of going to movies that I ever had the teller telling me that I probably shouldn't have just bought that ticket.
Yes. And there was actually one other thing. There's an additional scene that was filmed but then left out of the movie that showed a mutilated and naked Dr. Weir climbing from a ladder upside down, which was inspired by a movie we talked about at the very beginning of this show, The Exorcist. So bringing that completely full circle, Event Horizon.
Oh, yeah. Love Event it. Horizon! Dr. Captain Miller.
Take me away.
Then we'll rescue our friends from the gates of hell. Way back to the rest and wish them well. Head back to the ship and head on to Earth. Get our well-deserved leave back on Event Horizon.
We can't just sing the whole, like, they're going to kill us if we just end the show by singing the whole rest of that song. So instead...
What should we do?
We should do our junk food pairing! Hey, burp, burp, burp. This is where, like, music would be playing if we had an actual jingle for this segment, but we don't. We don't at all.
The junk food jingle?
The junk food jingle. For this week, I have chosen the Jawbreaker. Much like a Jawbreaker, when you first encounter Event Horizon, you think you know exactly what to expect. We've already talked twice about, oh, it's a crew on a ship, and there's an outside, it's kind of like Alien. Oh, it's like a haunted house in space, it's kind of like Alien. Oh, you know, it's a horror film, so the black guys, and well, of course, they're going to the blonde girl, they're all going to die. You think you know exactly what to expect. But as you work your way through it, you realize that both the film and the candy become more formidable, and that the experience is going to be a lot more involved than you thought. I mean, eventually, you'll work so hard to get to the center of that jawbreaker that, much like the cursed characters in the film, your eyes will liquefy, and you'll begin babbling nonsense to yourself, and it's at this point that you'll realize you didn't sign up for some passing confectionary distraction, but the sugar-coated descent into the pits of hell as your teeth shatter and float around the room like they do in the opening scene of this film! And you'll understand, the jawbreaker will show you that there is no escape, and you'll be locked in your bloody candy death spiral for the rest of eternity.
Yeah, I would have gone with chips and queso with that one.
You know what?
You know, because you know the thing with chips and queso, you know how event horizons actually work is that, you know, when you reach this certain point, you can't escape. And if you get too close to the chips and queso, you're going to be like, oh, no, I won't have any. But if somebody orders it and you're caught inside the event horizon of the chips and queso, you're going to sit there and you're going to destroy that chips and queso. It's just going to happen.
Well, you know, it also doesn't hurt that the gravity drive of the event horizon itself does kind of look like a big metallic jawbreaker. So either way.
Okay.
Eat a jawbreaker, go insane.
Jawbreaker, you know,
eat a jawbreaker, go insane.
Have some chips and queso.
Just for good measure. Well, that's going to do it for Junk Food Cinema this week. Thank you so much for taking the journey with us. I want to remind you yet again that we are available on iTunes as well as on Stitcher, that you can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And of course, those Amazon links that we've got there, please do consider if you're going to buy anything from Amazon, clicking there first, because that benefits us and we appreciate it. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me at twitter.com/massaworm, at massaworm on twitter.com, or it's M-A-S-S-A-W-Y-R-M, or at facebook.com/massaworm.
Hey, hey, hey. You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury. You can also find me on Facebook, facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic, or you can find me over at my other home, my home away from home, oneofus.net. Doing blogs, doing podcasts, generally
doing blow,
generally being a giant nerd who's coked out of his skull.
Blowing dudes.
Why not? Sure. Let's just keep on with that trend. Why not? Well, this has been fun, and I hope you have enjoyed the kickoff of our underrated horror of the 90s series. We'll be continuing that all through Schlocktober.
In the mouth of madness!
Within the mouth of madness! But for now, for Cargo, this is Brian. Here's hoping for many happy nightmares on the horizon.